Welcome to Ecogradia, where we meet experts and practitioners at the front lines of sustainable architecture and urbanism. My name is Nirmal Krishnani. I'm a sustainable design strategist, author, and educator based in Singapore. Today marks the beginning of sorts. This is the first webinar in a limited series organized in collaboration with the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. With this series, we want to cast a light on the inspiring work produced by the winners of the Holcim Awards 2023 cycle, which ended in Venice last November. So, each month, two winners will share with us the approach they took for the projects that earned them the top prizes and their professional insights on how sustainability can be successfully addressed in their part of the world. Today, my guests led the team that won the Gold Award for North America and Europe. Jonathan Diamond is a principal with Well-Grounded Real Estate, a developer in Canada. Their winning entry was for an innovative residential project in Toronto, the 1925 Victoria Park Avenue. And Camilo Garcia is an architect with the Spanish design firm Husos. Their winning entry was for the rehabilitation of an industrial building into a vibrant community hub in Madrid, the Infinito Delicias for the Daniel and Nina Carrasco Foundation. This webinar series is sponsored by the Holcim Foundation for Sustainable Construction. The foundation was created in 2003 to empower a community of future makers through the transfer of ideas, knowledge, and real-world solutions. The Holcim Foundation today delivers on all these fronts with a treasure trove of information on its website. You can find all past winners of the Holcim Awards from all over the world and discover the strategies they followed on their journey towards sustainability. Go to holcimfoundation.org to find out more. Jonathan, Camilo, it's a great pleasure to meet you. The thing that struck me about both your projects is just how important the act of integration is to sustainability goals. So each project brings together many systems and strategies, interests and expertise, metrics and methods. Without an appreciation of integration, the project would have turned out very differently. Integration is not a technology, nor is it a physical aspect of the building. It is the intelligence of the process. And because it is intangible, we do not often discuss or value it as much. And so the focus of today's webinar is multi-systemic integration. Before we start the conversation, walk me through your project. Starting with you, Jonathan, tell me a little bit about your award-winning project.
Thank you. So 1925 Victoria Park is a mid-rise rental building that consists of 185 large format units. The unit massing is constructed using a prefabricated timber hybrid system that is manufactured locally. The building features dual aspect units made possible by a broad single-loaded corridor encircling a central courtyard. This layout not only promotes passive strategies for ventilation, but also cultivates communal living spaces. The design prioritizes life cycle performance and operational efficiencies and uses an all-electric system with heating and cooling, both accomplished through active slab in the ceiling. The project is far from a one-off. Rather, it serves as a pivotal initiative, marking a prototype for a new systems-based model for delivering sustainable housing at scale. This model brings together Serotony Group's delivery platform for the CREE building system using productized design and decentralized manufacturing with a holistic development strategy that aligns capital, stakeholders, and land acquisition. We are committed to iterating this approach over subsequent buildings. This systems-based strategy embodies an industry step change for a robust solution to housing shortages, high housing costs, energy inefficiencies, and the high cost of construction that characterize Toronto's housing market, along with many other North American cities. Thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you, Jonathan. Camilo, would you take us through your project, please?
Thank you, Nirmal. This project is a rehabilitation of a former industrial building. It is called Infinito Delicias, which is an initiative promoted by the Daniel and Nina Carrasco Foundation. It is part of an integral 360 co-design process for a cultural innovation hub aimed to bring together communities dealing with sustainable food production, citizens' art, and social entrepreneurship. At the same time, it is meant to be a prototype of an exemplary way of building, which takes into account planetary care. In terms of spatial configuration, it is a mix including working spaces, spaces for events, meeting and rehearsal rooms, food labs, experimental kitchens, and a restaurant. This all will be intertwined with our permeable, multi-use, largely non-monetized spaces aiming to promote community engagement. And also, it will be regularly open to the neighborhood. Community empowerment will be also enhanced here by our governance and business models that are meant to create a new, particular new third space for the city, which will explore new forms of being together around sustainable food production and cultural exchange. In material terms, it combines different strategies, the reuse of an existing structure, the use of biomaterials, and the promotion of material circularity. And there will be a system of gardens for different purposes. One is providing the space with an energy-efficient bioclimatic envelope, which will provide interior and exterior comfort. And this will make the space much more livable, both to humans and to non-human animals, such as birds and insects. And it will bring also building habitants and passersby closer to sustainable food production and consumption cycles. The irrigation water for gardens and orchards is largely supplied by the use of collected rainwater. And in terms of energy saving, it will be supported mainly by the use of geothermal energy and solar power collection.
Thank you, Camilo. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
So let's break it down. Yeah, let's revisit what integration looks like at the drawing board or on the construction site. Tell me, first of all, how was the process in your project different from other projects of its kind where you operate? Starting with you, Camilo, how was this project different from many other projects in Madrid?
I think your question brings up a very important issue. I believe it's about methodologies. Regarding architecture, the challenges we face today in our discipline traverse all aspects of our life and cannot be understood isolated with compartmentalized knowledges or single disciplines or isolated working groups. There is an alternative path that has been put into practice in the design process of this project, which is what we call a 360 degrees approach, one in which diverse teams and communities that regularly work separately are working closely from the very beginning, from the early start of the project. So here, the architecture design works are led by a joint venture between Usos and Eli Architectural Studios. And the design of the program, which includes, among other tasks, the business model, governance, community making, and social innovation strategy, has been led by Ultrasul. But we were kind of working closely next to each other. And we as a group were in charge of developing a property and urban research, which was translated into a recommendation made to the foundation about a location, about a neighborhood, about a site. In this case, this included the upcycling of an existing building. That was kind of our suggestion after conducting this research, instead of starting from scratch on an empty plot. And this was accomplished working very, very closely with the Carazo Foundation. This has kind of a co-design, a very rich co-design process among these three entities, but there were also many other agents involved, such as agronomists or bioclimatic engineer experts, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I was reading on this project and you described the process as, you know, roundtables and meetings, surveys and interviews, data analysis. You had seven key research areas that were led by two transdisciplinary teams. That's a lot. I'm sure most typical projects do not undertake this level of complexity in Madrid. Would that be right?
Yeah, it is true. I mean, I know that in previous works, some of the team members have conducted similar initiatives with different agents and different times and different scales. Probably we had previous experiences in that, but there is a small group of people also conducting that type of work, but there is really, really a small minority doing this type of projects. It's rather a unique situation.
Right. Jonathan, how was Victoria Park Avenue different from the typical residential development in Toronto?
So traditionally, these projects are quite linear in nature. So you'll sort of start with land acquisition. You'll have some massing studies done by a planning firm, for example. You'll have an architecture firm that does a massing. Then you'll go to a cost consultant that does the pricing. And everything sort of gets sort of patched in. And nobody really has any sort of visibility into what everybody else is doing. And so when we contacted Partisans initially, and we interviewed a lot of different architects for this project. And then Partisans really was the only one who really had some sort of good creative ideas and sort of started there with Puya Baktash and Ivan Vasilev. And what we really wanted to do was, you know, develop, because we were the ultimate owners of this property, what we were really looking to do was saying, okay, how do we build something that we would be happy to own 40, 50 years into the future? And so when you start with that premise, you have all of the decision making that gets sort of filtered through that, filtered through in that way. Because we ultimately are the sort of the beneficiaries of both good and bad decisions. So that's sort of where it started. And then you sort of build an integrative team around it.
Yeah. I have to tell you, I've been involved in a integrated design process myself with a project in Singapore, and I know what an effort it is to bring so many different points of view and stakeholders together at the table and to kind of create some kind of consensus and alignment. But there is reason for doing an integrated process because it shapes outcomes, right? It gives you higher performance or it gives you better synergy between parts. Can you give me an example of one aspect of the project, maybe a performance outcome that would not have been achieved without the process? Starting with you, Jonathan, was there one thing that stood out because of its process?
Sure. I just want to qualify something just before we sort of get into it. You know, this project was a huge sort of learning endeavor for us. So the next one will be better. The next one will be better after that. And so, you know, Victoria Park is sort of hardly the culmination of it's sort of not the pinnacle here. There's lots of things that we would have done differently. There continues to be things that we are refining. So I just sort of want to start with that premise. So it really is sort of an evolution of this process where Vic Park is, let's say, a first marker of how well we've done. But to give you a concrete example, I would say energy usage, thermal regulation is probably the thing that stands out most. And this is really because it's actually quite an engineering challenge to thermal regulate a building properly. You know, in some sense, it's really easy. You can just build a thermos. Right, with, you know, no windows, no doors, nothing. You just stick people inside and you'll have very little sort of heat transfer between the inside and outside, but that's hardly a living space. And so the question becomes, you know, how do we start, right? And, you know, this really does involve a lot of different layers. You've got the actual structure, which, you know, in our opinion, should be as passive as possible. And then once you have a passive structure, then you can layer on sort of a mechanical system. And then even within the mechanical system, you have an energy source. You have a primary energy source, which might be, you know, in the past it was coal, right, to heat. We're in Canada, right? So heating is the largest energy load. You know, you had coal, then you move to oil. Then you have natural gas. And then you have a boiler or a furnace. Then you have the delivery system throughout the building. And so, you know, you kind of have to think of this as layers. And you want to be optimizing the entire system, not just an individual layer in that system. And so in this building, we don't have a gas connection at all. It's completely all electric. But that is only made possible because of a high-performance envelope and the way we've done radiant heating and radiant cooling. And so... again, you can't just optimize one component. You have to look at the entire picture as the goal.
The whole process is predicated on having everyone at the table at the beginning, is it not? I mean, in a conventional project, you would tend to layer in the experts or the work. There would be a kind of a workflow where one person does one thing and hands off to the other. But my understanding of the IDP, the integrated design process, is that you actually need everyone at the beginning sitting down together and brainstorming. Is that what you did?
Yes and no. So we didn't really undertake a formal IDP process per se, but let's say we were highly influenced by it. So we did sort of explore it formally at one point, but thought we could sort of put our own sort of spin on it. But indeed, we did have a lot of stakeholders at the beginning, and really, what the point of this all. What these structures are is to really focus on the goals and the outcome instead of having these like sub projects that emerge, which is like the biggest way to make mistakes in these projects is to just focus on like just the mechanical system or like just the structural system without understanding how everything fits together, because it's very, very probable that you have a suboptimal individual system that yields an optimal system overall, and that's what you're trying to achieve.
Right. Nicely put. Camilo, one aspect of the performance that you think was shaped by the process that you put in place.
Yeah, I want to point you one example in relation to that, but maybe I just wanted also to go back a little bit to the previous question, because there was something I just wanted to add about this small minority of people working in this direction, which I believe there are several reasons for that. And one is undoubtedly because of the misunderstanding we have, at least in the West and in great part of the westernized world, where non-human nature is often perceived as an infinite source of resources, and often also as a dumping site, which corresponds to this binary epistemological system in which nature and humans have been understood as two separate things. And I think possibly a less extractivist perception of nature and a more complete view of the social, of the communities, could help us to build a more comprehensive understanding of the economy of a building, including spheres often invisibilized or uncounted in the traditional economy discourses, such as nature, such as communities, community impacts, especially in the global South. And I think this will definitely help us in addressing long-term well-being, not only immediate short-term profit, and of course, life cycle assessment, for example, has been an important tool, but it's far from being addressing these issues that are I'm mentioning you. And coming back to your question about an example of this, the importance of this collaboration, I think in a complex frame such as this one, exercising attentive and carefully listening to all parts becomes really important, becomes a central practice and essential, especially working with heterogeneous views and if you're trying to make a win-win, to get a win-win responses. So for example, in the case of the project, there was a healthy controversy between the business plan and the community and the people who were in charge of creating this community, you know, which is both are essential to the project. And this controversy was over the ratio of monetized areas versus spaces that should be non-monetized, which are required to stimulate this community making. In this case, what we did was to conduct a broad research, which is part of these processes as well, of looking at existing examples. And this showed us that around 30% of those non-program areas were key to have to stimulate the creation of a vibrant community exchange, who hopefully will be able to interact with a large degree of freedom in those spaces.
Right.
So there was a need to have these spaces rented out once every time during the year, but at the same time we should have also these non-program spaces. And the idea is that working together, the people in charge of the design, the people dealing with the governance, with the business plan, and with the project goals, which was in this case the foundation, we managed to come to a compromise in which those spaces will be rent out for a few events during the year, keeping a balance between the two.
Mm. So I gather from what you say that the circle of stakeholders expands, right? So it's not just the people that are directly affected by the building or the operations of the building, but also it's the neighborhood, the community. But beyond that, the idea of nature becomes a stakeholder. Okay, how does nature have a seat at the table? How do you do that?
That's a very good question, and I think we have had people in the group some previous experience in this. One of them is bringing people who are dealing with that, botanists and people dealing with the fauna and flora that are present in the city and who have observed that, and there is something that needs to be understood when you are dealing with nature in a project, and it's basically that the time of the end of a project really expands, and there's not really like a beginning and an end because you don't know exactly how it's going to behave. So you have to kind of take into account that there is going to be changes over time, that the evolution of those other agents is probably going to be predicted to a certain extent, but it will be also evolving and changing throughout the time. So I think that the idea of ending a project really, there really has to be thought about it, because there's not really kind of an end when you are dealing with those other agents. Yeah.
Mm. I mean, I think it's really interesting that we begin by defining sustainability as a performative issue of what happens within the site and shell, but very quickly, in both projects, there is a wider question that becomes incorporated, right? So each of your project has an impact that goes beyond the question of what happens within the site boundary. It kind of offers us a lessons on what the design construction sector at large might be doing. Jonathan, in your submission to the Holcim Awards, you talked about a new model for development that can scale to meet Toronto's ambitious housing goals. Talk me through that. Tell me what that means.
So the way these projects are typically produced is very individual. Like, they're almost like custom houses. So Puya talks a lot about this, where each project is a one-off. And the problem with this, what do I mean by that? Well, you have an architect that designs a building. You've got engineers that sort of build out the mechanical systems and structural systems and all of this. You build the thing. You sell all the units or rent them, and then you move on to the next project. And there's very little there's very little sort of learning from one project to the other. You sort of get good at doing that again, but there's no scale in terms of eliminating redundancy of design work, for example, or even construction work for that matter. So there's no sort of compounding experience. Let's say this model is not iterative in nature. And so when we talk about the system, we're talking about sort of a new way of developing. And you have to be very, very careful in this industry to distinguish between improvements of the current system and switching the model. And improvements aren't bad, of course. Improvements, by definition, are improvements. But if you're within a format that is suboptimal, all you're doing is just making that suboptimal format a little bit better. So what we're trying to do is kind of step outside that and create a model that scales. And so how do you scale? One, you have to eliminate the design work, the design redundancy. So what Puya and Ivan through Sarotany are really working on is how do you digitize these systems so that you can design faster, which has performance elements that fall out of these models, which has pricing that falls out of these models, so that you don't have to reinvent the wheel every single time. And then on the manufacturing side, when you're dealing with prefabrication, one of the problems that we typically run into is that you deal with a specific company that does everything in-house, which eliminates a lot of the benefits of prefabrication. So a lot of the benefits are like price control and price transparencies. And when you have a company that's centralizing all of this, You don't know how much their glue lamp costs. You don't know how much their concrete costs. You don't know what's going on. It's a black box, right? And so, you know, what we're exploring with Cree Building Systems and what they're set up to do is to manufacture this stuff in a decentralized format that don't actually require specialized manufacturers. So there's these precast concrete companies all over the place. And when you produce these buildings in a decentralized format, number one, you're eliminating the bottlenecks. You have complete price control because we're sourcing the glue lamb ourselves. And you also don't need to invest or create any new infrastructure in order for this to be made. And then you actually get parallel design and parallel manufacturing, because if you're doing multiple of these projects simultaneously, you can start to design to minimize sort of panel diversity between buildings, for example. And so in this case, you actually gain benefits from scale instead of having scale cause bottlenecks and problems.
That's fascinating. Camilo, you talk about rethinking the model as well. You've called it the Integral 360 co-design process. It's interesting. I think here is where the two projects perhaps diverge a little bit in my mind, where I think, Jonathan, the Toronto project is very much looking at scalability and modularity and prefabrication and the economic model of development, whereas the Madrid project seems to be looking at the social model of development. Would that be fair, Camilo?
Yes. I think there is the 360 understanding of the project. It's also a 360 understanding of the economy of the project in terms of including in that measurement all of these usually unmeasured parts, such as the community impact or the impact over nature, no? But also there is a interesting exercise here that the foundation is making. They are making a strong bid to match the ends with the means of funding. So they're using part of the endowment of this operation, which will need to produce some profits to be reinvested in the activities they fund. So they're using this project to actually create new funds for promoting what they do, no? So the project it becomes a source of profits while also being a goal in itself. And it should also be economically self-sustained. So for achieving this, we needed to have this broad theme, these large different types of backgrounds, of knowledges, and I think for all of us in the team and also for the foundation, it was important to kind of measure the implications of and cost of using certain material, natural resources, and to measure the social impact and to aim to create these long-term benefits. And I think here we sort of connect with this idea of time in the project, which is, I think, for us and for many people in the team, the project is actually the building, but there is something bigger than that, which is what can the actual project suggest or how can you produce new imaginaries that will suggest new paths, new ways of acting? We don't know exactly what is going to happen there. We don't know what people is going to do, but what we can work with is within the creation of these other imaginaries in which, of course, the interaction with the community will be important. It will be kind of unexpected, but we can suggest paths and ways in which these things can happen.
Do you think, Camilo, that this developmental model will be adopted by others in your city, in Spain, for that matter? I mean, if yes, what will drive it? You know, will it be codes or returns on investment? How will this model propagate?
I think I was discussing this earlier. I mean, there is a few colleagues, a few people who are working in this direction. It's a very small minority, and I think this has to do with the with the set mind, no, with the way in which we think we approach things in this dichotomy, no, and this kind of division, which is not really there, because we are nature. This building is also nature. So if we understand those two combined, and we try to break this binary epistemological situation in which we learn that nature is something and human is other thing, maybe we can start to conceive nature in a less extractivist way, and I think there will be space for more people working in this other direction, no, instead of just going for the immediate short term profit, no, looking for long term well being. So for me, I think the projects we are discussing here today, and I think the projects in the Holcim Awards in general really can contribute to accelerate the discussion of these urgent issues at different levels, no?
Jonathan, how will this developmental model propagate in Toronto in Canada?
I mean, things in the private market will propagate if they're better. And so when people see a better way of doing things, and I'll define better as call it faster, cheaper, and higher quality. This is kind of what we're hoping to achieve. And so if you have buildings that can be built in half the time at a much cheaper price, it will be a more attractive model going forward. One of the things that we're really interested in, and I've thought a lot about recently, is energy sources. And energy has been pretty cheap, historically speaking. And so there actually hasn't been much of incentive to improve how much energy a building is consuming. Victoria Park, 1925 Victoria Park, is an all-electric building. And we want to produce only all-electric buildings going forward. And the reason is because, unlike natural gas, which is a primary energy source, electricity is a secondary energy source. It can be derived from natural gas or coal. And in the case of Ontario, it's largely nuclear. Solar and wind, of course, depending on the geography, geothermal. And so everything can actually, most energy sources can reduce to electricity. And so if you have an all-electric building that's also hyper-efficient, you'll have cheaper energy bills for the tenants. It will consume less energy overall. And it's also robust from a business perspective to changes in the energy landscape. So if there's policy changes that want to move away from natural gas burning, which there is already in Canada, you are already set up to accommodate that. If natural gas becomes more expensive in the future, which it likely will, you are robust and protected against that. And so with a lot of these sort of sustainable strategies, there's actually a very good business decision for pursuing that. And demonstrating that these aren't vanity projects, but these are very practical, functional projects that solve real-world problems will be the only way that these projects can multiply in a sustainable and organic way.
Do you think that codes and regulations have a role to play in this? I mean, I hear what you're saying about a bottom-up kind of transformation of the marketplace, but in both your projects, the question of replicability remains the holy grail, so to speak. You know, they're both great projects, but how do you scale them up? And if it's kind of left to the marketplace or to individuals like yourself, you know, with intelligence and goodwill, then we may not see it happening as quickly as we would wish. So I'm throwing this out there as a provocation. Do you think regulation is the way forward, or is there something else that is going to trigger change? Starting with you, Camillo, what do you think?
Well, I think this is a really big, interesting question. I think sometimes regulations and codes are really important. But also going back to kind of your question about how to achieve replicability, how to achieve that there are more projects going in these directions, I think there must be, if we are searching for an eco-social transformation, we require to design strategies in which what we are creating are also somehow infrastructures of desire and something that people really want, something because only they can be replicable and they can be sustained over time if people really like them, if people are attracted and they think that they are beautiful and they are fun. So I think that there must be, you know, also something that is in the hands of the design of the software, the hardware, the spaces, and the performance, the performativity of these spaces. No, so yeah, we see that there is an opportunity to find these new sources of pleasure by creating this type of spaces or trying to.
I absolutely love the phrase infrastructure of desire. I'm going to use that the next time. Jonathan, what do you think is going to make this replicable?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, I echo what Camilo is saying. I mean, I think if you have buildings and structures that people want to live in, this is sort of the ultimate incentive for anyone that's creating housing, is creating these like amazing social spaces that people want to live in. To reflect on your original question here about sort of government regulation and policy, I mean, I think that's absolutely an important factor in housing in general. Toronto, Canada, more generally, is there's a lot of code and zoning and site plan regulations that actually prohibit the production of good sustainable housing, which is ironic because we're currently find ourselves in a housing crisis. These are things that are changing slowly. I don't know whether it's just a product of me being in this world that I hear it more, or change is actually happening. But there's lots of discussions about how to sort of promote the development of these types of buildings. There's sort of two ways of thinking about it. One is sort of incentives, which is how do we draw developers to create these types of buildings and designers to design them. No doubt that's important. But the other factor is, let's look at all of the barriers that are currently in place that prevent those and just get rid of those, right? So if you start with the premise that all regulation is slow and expensive, right? Doesn't matter how you cut it. All regulation is slow and expensive. The question is, given the cost and time it takes to, abide by these rules, what are you getting for it? And so there has to be a societal benefit that overwhelms the cost, or that exceeds the cost and time. And the problem is, we have a lot of, specifically with respect to code, for example, we have a lot of code in place that actually makes it illegal to build a lot of sustainable structures. And so getting rid of anything in zoning, site plan, or code that is not conducive to sustainable structures would be an amazing place to start. But I do think it is, I think the government certainly has obligations on their end to minimize barriers. And the developers and designers and builders have an obligation on their end to create things in the world that they operate in. So it really is this sort of this two-way street.
I hear what you're saying, that code can be problematic at many levels, but again, it could also be the inverse, right? Just because there is bad code, I suppose, it doesn't mean that you can't have good code. They're not mutually exclusive. Well, listen, I want to thank both of you, Jonathan, Camilo, for talking to me today. It's been a great pleasure. Congratulations on your amazing projects. Are they completed? I know that reading on both projects that they were close to completion. Am I right, Jonathan? Is Victoria Park Avenue completed?
It's not completed. So we haven't broken ground yet. So this is coming up early 2025.
All right, Camilo, what about your project? How far away is that?
Yeah, project is now under construction. Started in September, and it's supposed to be finished next February 2025. So yeah,
brilliant. Jonathan, Camilo, thank you for being with us today to kickstart this new series of webinars. It was a pleasure to have you on and to hear you explain the thinking behind the projects. Congratulations again on winning the gold at the HOSIM Awards 2023. A big thank you to the sponsor of this series, the HOSIM Foundation for Sustainable Construction. The foundation is a leading organization whose sole mission is to promote new ways of thinking and acting in the design construction sector globally. Their goal is to give you the resources you need to craft your own journey and make that journey a little easier. To learn more about the winning projects featured in today's episode, plus who else will be appearing on upcoming episodes, go to wholesomefoundation.org. Thanks, everyone. Until next time, this is Nirmal Kishnani signing off in Singapore.